Thank you for listening to this Podcast One production. Available on Apple Podcasts and Podcast One.
Podcast One presents Fully Booked by Kirkus Reviews, the ultimate insider's scoop on the best new books. Every week, Kirkus brings you author interviews, recommendations from the bestseller lists, and insights into books that are not yet on your radar.
Hi, I'm Megan LaBrise, editor-at-large of Kirkus Reviews. Welcome to another episode of Fully Booked. Thank you so much for joining us. My guest this week is Anne Helen Peterson, author of Can't Even, How Millennials Became the Burnout Generation. It's out today from HMH. Millennials, once more for the people in the back, are those of us born between 1981 and 1996, roughly. There are 73 million millennials in the United States, making us the largest generation. Some of us are straight up middle-aged. Nevertheless, this generation is having a hard time getting a toehold on the ladder of prosperity. That good old American dream, work hard and you'll ascend to greatness, was amended for us. Furthermore, we must do what we love, so we'll never work a day in our lives. But stress, student debt, increasing income inequality, and the need to achieve is pushing many millennials to their breaking point. And those who do achieve traditional markers of success seem to be having a really hard time enjoying them. Peterson's in-depth investigation into the mechanisms of millennial burnout grew out of a piece she read for BuzzFeed News, where she is a senior culture writer. The piece has more than 7 million views to date. We'll talk about her methods for growing her insights and expanding that into the full-length consideration Kirkus calls, quote, a well-researched and rendered analysis of why so many millennials feel overwhelmed despite their best efforts, end quote. Starred review for Can't Even. Anne Helen Peterson is the author of Too Fat, Too Slutty, Too Loud, and Scandals of Classic Hollywood. As said, she's a senior culture writer for BuzzFeed News. A former academic, she received her PhD from the University of Texas at Austin, where she focused on the history of celebrity gossip. She will join us soon, but first, a word from one of our sponsors for this episode, Amazon Crossing, about the memoir A Drop of Midnight by Jason Diakité. Born to interracial American parents in Sweden, Jason Diakité grew up between worlds. Part Swedish, American, Black, White, Cherokee, Slovak, and German, riding a delicate cultural and racial divide. It was a no-man's land that left him in constant search of self. Even after his hip-hop career took off, Jason fought to unify a complex system of family roots that branched across continents, ethnicities, classes, and eras to find a sense of belonging. What he found was a story only he can tell. Read or listen to Jason Diakité's moving memoir, A Drop of Midnight, for free with Amazon Prime. Visit amazon.com/a drop of midnight. And now let's talk with Anne Helen Peterson, author of Can't Even, How Millennials Became the Burnout Generation. Welcome, Anne, to Fully Booked. Thank you so much for joining me today.
Hi, I'm so happy to be here.
I'm really, really excited and honored, honestly, to get the privilege to speak with you again. We got to talk for a print feature back when you published Too Fat, Too Slutty, Too Loud, The Rise and Reign of the Unruly Woman. And that was great. And it reminds me that, like, I pulled a line from my notes for preparing for that first interview with you. And in the introduction to that book, there's this quote, "They're constant reminders of the chasm between what we think we believe and how we actually behave," end quote. And I started thinking about that line in relation to this new book just out, Can't Even, How Millennials Became the Burnout Generation. Any thoughts on that?
I mean, I think that we have come up with all sorts of different ways to keep going, you know, pre-pandemic or now. And we tell ourselves one story in order to keep going, right? In order to compartmentalize. And that is not always in line with, you know, how things actually are. So, yeah, I think that, you know, ideology surrounds us in all sorts of ways. I'm kind of obsessed with thinking through how ideology dictates our actions and our belief systems. And so, you know, we are constantly trying to figure out oh, what do I actually believe, right? And how do I articulate what I believe? And how do I feel inside? Like, how do I actually feel about all of these things?
That's really interesting to me about ideology, because I one question I wanted to ask you is, as a journalist, what do you consider your beat to be?
Culture.
Yeah. Fair enough.
very narrowed down. I really think, you know, I think so many things are interesting. Like, basically anything that you talk to me about, I'm like, oh, that's really interesting. Tell me more about it. So I've always thought of myself as someone who is broadly interested in all of these different corners and crannies of culture. And that can mean political culture. It can mean book culture. It can mean feminism. It can mean, what's going on in the with weather patterns in the Pacific Northwest, which is right now.
Uh-oh.
All sorts of things. So yeah, I think of it broadly, but I guess digging further into those corners of it.
You wrote an article for BuzzFeed, published in January 2019, How Millennials Became the Burnout Generation. And that title actually became the subtitle of this book. I'm seeing. My matching skills are on point.
Good. Yes. You know, in publishing, you have to like put some sort of like catchy title, right? Before the colon. So we came up with Can't Even, and then took the title of my actual article.
And that article, that has at this point more than 7 million readers, right?
Yes.
Tremendous. Is that your most successful article of all time?
Yes.
Click-wise.
Yeah. It is.
Why, at this late date, after expanding it into a book-length work and doing all of the research and interviews you did to, like, flesh it all out, why do you think it hit so hard?
I think that it just kind of gave a little bit of form to this larger feeling that people who are millennials in particular, but I think it obviously extends, just because you were born in 1979 does not mean that you are not feeling a lot of these things. Just that the general language to be able to have a conversation about what you're feeling. And going back to, you know, the first part of our conversation, people have felt like something has been wrong for a while. But it was difficult to know how to identify it, let alone have a conversation about it.
Right. And I mean, one part of having a successful conversation is sharing vocabulary. So could we get like a working definition of burnout for the purpose of this podcast?
Well, the way I'm sorry, I'm sighing so much. It's just the world is a lot right now. And for me, burnout is when you hit a wall. And instead of like collapsing and replenishing yourself in some capacity, like rejuvenating, recovering, you hit the wall and then you scale the wall and then you keep going more. So it's the sort of exhaustion in all corners of your life that just becomes the backdrop of your life.
I'm born in 1982. You're born in 1981, correct?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Have we ever not experience burnout? Is this a case of a dawning realization?
Well, I think burnout, as I'm thinking about it, is very closely drawn to capitalism. So I think when capitalism is making life really difficult for most people, then yeah, a lot of people are burnt out. And the times in our past, specifically like during the post-war period when capitalism was pretty well regulated and benefiting a much broader swath across America of people, and that, you know, basically the expansion of the middle class and adding stability to millions of Americans' life, not just through capital, but just like not being terrified of what the future will bring at all times. I think there was less burnout then, but it is, I think, affiliated with our American understanding of how work should work, right? Like that more work is always better work. And also that an increasing understanding that people, especially middle-class people, are defined by the work that they do. So there's not necessarily a lot of other self that is available to be meaningful outside of that.
What are a few of the key turns in American history that really led us to where we are now? How did we become so disenfranchised and desperate and clinging on to the jobs we have as if you know, we're on the side of a ledge.
I think the easiest way to think about it is that there have just been so many safety nets that have either been removed or have never been built in the first place. And a lot of that has to do with decreased support for workers just generally in the form of unions. But then also things like the tempification of society. There's this fantastic book called Temp by Lewis Hyman that looks back at the temp agencies of the 1960s and 70s and is able to trace the ways in which, like, this idea of, okay, we are in the, we have the standard of treating workers okay, right? Treating workers as humans. How can we stop that? And the first way to do so was really to figure out, well, we can put in these temp workers who we don't have to treat like, we can treat them like robots, essentially. Right. And that became the new standard of how to make a, you know, a desirable company, a more profitable company, is figuring out how can we treat our workers less like humans and decrease some of that stability in their lives. But I also think, you know, apart from all of the economic shifts, which I tried to work through, like, there are things like, you know, in the 1980s, there were choices made both in terms of, like, who we elected and then what those legislators did to do things like defund state-funded colleges on a pretty wide scale across the United States. And what that meant is that you have an increase in how much tuition is required to go to these schools. And that then leads to increases in student debt and how something like broad scale, wide scale student debt can really contribute to this feeling of burnout, especially when you feel like you're never going to get out from underneath it.
Womp, womp. You really do feel that way, too. I'm 15 years out from my undergraduate degree and still receiving that bill every month.
Yep. I know. Same. Like, yeah. I just keep chipping away at it. And I'm finally paying down the principal. And that just feels like, you know, revelatory. But so many millennials I know, you know, they look at their statements and every month it's just like, there's just more interest, you know, and it's not like something like a house where you're like, you know, you can excuse it by thinking that you are gaining equity and someday you'll be able to benefit from it. I mean, that's the premise in some ways of a college education, but that premise, like, does not come to bear.
They really got us.
And it took me a long time to kind of unravel that idea that a lot of us, I think, internalized from across the United States and also in lots of different class positions and different identity backgrounds, that, like, the way to stability would be college, right? If you can just get a degree, then you'll be fine. And if you really want to be stable, go to grad school, which is, such not the case. But, like, so just trying to think about where that idea came from and how the myth persists when it's not, it's just flatly not true that college leads to stability.
Right, right. And for whom does what lead to stability is really kind of interesting. And in an ongoing thread in this book, you say that you purposefully wanted to decenter the white middle-class experience. And that was an essential aspect of this book. Why was that important for you to pay attention to?
You know, I think that I first came up with the framework of millennial burnout by looking at my own life, right? By trying to analyze my own life and coming up with this framework and, like, kind of putting it over, oh, here's what I was doing in high school and here's what I was doing in college and right after college and in grad school. And that gave me an understanding of that I was able to extrapolate to some extent beyond my personal experience. But I think when I decided to do the book project, I really wanted to go just beyond, obviously, that experience. Right. And I wanted to talk to so many people who aren't like me, right? Who, you know, whether that's in terms of where they grew up, what their parents were like, what their class position was growing up, their attitudes towards college and all sorts of things, whether or not their parents, you know, like, there's a whole chapter of the book that's devoted to millennial parenting, and I'm not a parent. But I thought that, like, how can I try to dig into the experience of being a millennial, especially when so many of the things that we just associate with being millennial now, like in popular culture, they're for sure things that are associated with being a bougie white millennial.
Right. So, right. Avocado toast. Right.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So how do we texture that even more?
There's so many lanes to go down now. Right to work, risk shift, class anxiety, Barbara Ehrenreich. Like, I honestly feel a little bit like who we didn't start the fire, you know, like I feel like we could just come, you know, hit after hit with all of these phrases. What do you want listeners to know about this book? Do you want to talk about how work got so shitty, how precarity became the status quo, why work stays so shitty? Like, what do you want to talk about?
I just did the audio version of the book. So it's kind of a nice thing to do because you reread your entire book.
Yeah.
So there's so many things that are like, that are just so vivid in my mind right now. I mean, I think that I've been thinking obviously a lot about how the pandemic affects burnout. But right now, you know, there's been all these wildfires in the West where we are. And one of my kind of burnout salves are like one of the preventative things that I do when I can feel kind of that burnout behavior coming on is I try to spend time outside. Like it is very, very useful to me to go out and garden and to just spend time out just on long walks with my dog. And having that kind of that one window, that one like pandemic release closed off to me, I feel really stuck. And trapped, I guess, is a better word. And I think, I'm lucky, like I didn't lose my home. I'm just dealing with smoke.
Right.
And so I'm wondering, you know, at this moment, people have kind of been trying to figure out how much burnout, how much exhaustion and frustration and fear that they can take over the course of the year. And it feels like a breaking point for a lot of people right now.
Oh yeah, I'm living proof. You know, it's like you can't hear a cringe on a podcast, but as you were discovering that, it's like I don't know. I'm originally from New York. I live in Portland, Oregon. Right now, I live in a cloud of smoke. It's inside my house. I had to take off my N95 mask to perform this podcast today. You know, it's like, and I'm having trouble even keeping my thoughts aligned because I'm breathing in who knows what even.
Yep.
You know, I don't have an AC. I don't have an air freshener.
Well, I mean, smoke makes it so that you can't. Well, it makes you crabby, first of all.
Yeah.
And then it also makes it hard to think, right?
It does.
So, and like there are these lines that we can draw with coronavirus, like COVID, also people who are recovering from COVID or like still in the thick of it, like their brains don't work, right? So the one thing that a lot of us have is like, oh, well, at least I can still think straight. Like, at least I can still do my job. Like, what happens when that ability is taken away? Like, what is left?
Right? Yeah. And that's the ultimate panic because the job is the one string you're holding on to. It's like, well, at least I have my job.
Yep.
You know, and there's all this relative thinking. It's like, I'm lucky for this. I'm lucky for the N95 mask that I'm wearing in my house.
Right.
You know?
Right. And that's sort of, relativism, for lack of a better word. I think that oftentimes, like clearly you should, I think relativism is valuable in so much as it encourages us to think about the extent of suffering and burnout and difficulty for people who are in different positions than we are. But at the same time, sometimes, especially depending on your personality and your gender, sometimes it encourages us to not actually acknowledge just how bad things are, right?
Right.
And it's okay, I think, in this moment, you know, whether you're dealing with the fires or you're dealing with COVID or you're dealing with financial precarity, to be very honest about, like, I'm struggling, you know?
Yeah. You represent so many voices in this book, and your reader gets the impression that, you know, your subjects were pretty honest with you. I mean, what was that process like for you to receive all of these highly personal stories from how many people did you interview?
Well, so I did a Google survey form situation,
okay,
which I have used in the past, and I have found that it is particularly effective both at just getting a wider net of interviewees, but then also a lot of people, especially burnt out people, are reticent to like schedule a time, right? They're like, I'm not going to like get on the phone and schedule a time. Like, yeah. But if you have these open text windows, it really provides an opportunity to expound, or kind of like a privacy almost, right? Mm-hmm. So if people, like if I had follow-up questions or that sort of thing, I would follow up with people. But the answer to your question is I heard from over 10,000 people total.
Wow.
I did different surveys for different chapters. And so the numbers were just pretty monumental. Mm-hmm. But, and I read everyone's stories, because I think like that's actually a pretty good way of seeing the themes that pop up over and over again, or even like the words. Like I would notice a word that would keep popping up, and I'd like do, you know, the control F to see just how many times it would come up over the course of 2,500 people who had responded about something like, you know, one of the surveys was about leisure. Mm-hmm. And so people who like the word pressure, right? So how many times do people use that word to describe what they felt, either from themselves or from others, to monetize a hobby? But I think just like how people responded to my article by saying to me, like, I feel like I'm less alone. I feel seen. I feel like other people are feeling this too. Mm-hmm. That was the process of reading all these stories. It's like, people are feeling this. Like, this is not just me. This is very much something that maybe doesn't apply to every single person in a generation, because nothing can ever apply to every single person, but that right. does feel systemic.
Right. Because one thing that this book does really well too, I think, is it emphasizes that it isn't a personal problem. Like, you are not the one specific loser who is not keeping up with all of your fancy friends on Instagram. Like, it's a societal one.
Exactly. And I hope that, I mean, there are many things that I hope people take away from the book, but one of them is the refrain that I think was not subtle at all, which is that you can't fix burnout by addressing any sort of personal problems. You can try to alleviate it, you can put a Band-Aid on it, but this is a societal problem.
Right. I think another refrain that I took from it, at least, is it doesn't have to be like this.
Yeah.
Could you talk about that a little bit?
I think that not only do we have some examples of, you know, in our pretty recent past in America of how capitalism could work differently and could be more distributive, and how companies could work differently. You know, there's this great book that I draw on pretty heavily called The Good Job Strategy. And in this book, the author Zeynep Tun looks at companies. One is a company in Spain, and then she looks at Quick Trip, which is a gas station company in the United States.
Yeah.
And then Trader Joe's, and there's one other one I'm blanking on, but looking at basically these companies that have figured out that if you treat workers really well, if you make their jobs feel secure in some way, and that good work, loyalty, all these things are compensated, then you actually, like, your profits increase, right?
Yeah.
Because people who feel security want to do a better job, are able to do a better job.
I loved learning about Quick Trip, which was a total revelation for me.
Right?
I had no idea. Little did I know that when I was filling up my car, I was actually helping to sustain a pretty damn good corporate structure where at least the woman that you portray in the book, she was able to keep regular hours, still live her life and serve her family and have a good time. And she was they promote internally. Mm-hmm. So she had risen to this level where she was making, it sounds to me like, you know, from what I've seen some really dispiriting numbers lately, but like starting tenure professor money.
Yeah, totally. Way more than a contingent lecturer does.
Yeah.
I think that one of the falsehoods that we keep is that like there's a certain type of work that is always going to be shitty and exploitative.
Yeah.
Right? But like labor, any sort of manual work should be that way, or quote unquote unskilled work. So work that doesn't require a college degree. Mm-hmm. But, you know, if your company is able to serve more people and has more loyal customers and doesn't have to deal with rampant turnaround of employees because it treats its workers better, like that can be a good job. Good job. There are all sorts of good jobs, right, across the spectrum. And so much of it has to do with a company or an employer's willingness to think of its employees as humans.
Right. They are their own kind of microcosm, or like they've instituted a system that is more equal.
Yeah.
Than prevailing. It's interesting. A few weeks ago, I had the privilege of speaking with Eula Biss about having and being had her new her new collection, and she's really considering her, you know, privilege and how she got what she has and the discomfort of being comfortable, you know, as a white middle class, upper middle class person living in the suburbs of Chicago. I mentioned to her this book that had a pretty big impact on me from 2019. It's The Inner Level, How More Equal Societies Reduce Stress, Restore Sanity, and mm-hmm. Improve Everyone's Well-Being by Richard Wilkinson and Kate Pickett. Are you familiar with it?
I've heard of it, but I haven't read it. But I mean, the title, like, I agree with it.
Yeah. And to me, when you say in this book, it doesn't have to be like this, I think of that book. And to me, I mean, you know, I'm no epidemiologist as they are, but it seemed to the impression I was left with was that if you institute more just or equal systems, if you institute a policy that is more like distributes resources more equally within the company or within the country, it kind of doesn't matter what your motivation was for doing that. But like once that is instituted, eventually people like will chill a little bit.
Yeah.
We'll be at each other a little bit less. We'll be less burnt out.
Yes, absolutely. You're right. Like it doesn't matter if you have like, you know, a benevolent CEO who's like, I think of workers as humans, or if you have regulations top down from the federal government that insists that you do this, or
right.
if it's like kind of a collaboration between a corporation and a union coming to that place of distribution. Like if you can get to a more distributive place like that, It affects everything, right? It affects
right.
happiness levels. It affects parenting strategies, everything, top down. And I think that there maybe is too much disconnect right now between the fact that like, oh, we're at one of the highest points of income inequality in our history. I wonder why everything is bad right now.
You know, because there always were Republicans and Democrats. There always were conservatives and liberals. Like, but it just seems like right now there's like we've reached a fever pitch. I mean, I don't know about, you know, like around Portland in the suburbs right
yeah.
now, there are armed militias
yep.
guarding various, you know, towns where the smoke and fire ran through. They're knocking on everybody's windows, finding out if they are friend or foe or just DoorDash.
Right. Well, and this, you know, there's a lot going on there.
Right.
I've reported
right.
that in other places. But
yeah.
at the same time, I think so much of what motivates us and allows us to accept different ideologies, whether it's racism or individualism or whatever, so much of it is fear and so much of it is instability. So when you have widespread instability in our country, you know, because of this virus that has not been controlled. I mean, I saw yesterday that like Canada reported that there are zero deaths from COVID.
Right.
Yesterday. Like, and that, I mean, I'm right near the Canadian border right now. I'm on Lummi Island in Washington State, and I could get to Canada. Like, I can see Canada. I'm listening to like the top 40 station from Canada. Like, they have had it. They have figured it out. And we have this incredible instability that is just racking our country. And so, of course, this stuff is going to happen. That doesn't excuse it. That doesn't,
right.
like, make it any better. But I think it's easy to connect the dots between financial and health instability and just overarching unrest.
Yeah. To me, like, as my thought has progressed in this sector, I kind of think that maybe it's time to abandon changing hearts and minds and then just work to change those little tiny policy details from the bottom up.
Yep. Yep.
Like,
yep.
You know.
Yeah, and like, not to sound too Liz Warren, but like, make capitalism work for the worker.
Yeah.
That can actually have like incredible systemic like changes in our society.
Oh, well, I see that we have been talking for a God, the smoke. Oh my God. I can barely get the words out. I see we're at time and I could speak with you all day if I could breathe through it. But is there anything else you would like our listeners to know about this book or about capitalism?
Well, here's one thing that several people have said to me is they
yeah.
said, I'm really excited for your book. I fear I am too burnt out to actually tackle it right now.
Ah, yeah.
And I 100% get it. Like figuring out how to read again, has been like a significant process for me. But I think that, like, there are points, the book goes kind of chronologically, like starts with our burnt out parents and then goes through to millennial parenting. But there are so many different points of access where you can just start with like a couple of pages and not feel like you have to grapple with a whole big book. So hopefully that makes people feel a little bit more welcome to the text.
Wherever you start, however much you read, just start it.
Yep.
The book is called Aunt Even. I've been speaking with Anne Helen Peterson. Anne, thank you so much for joining me today on Fully Booked.
It's my pleasure. Thank you so much.
That was Anne Helen Peterson, author of Can't Even, How Millennials Became the Burnout Generation, out today from Houghton Mifflin Harcourt. After the break, we'll ask our editors for their top picks and books for the week.
You're listening to Fully Booked by Kirkus Reviews. The ultimate insider scoop on the latest books, right here on Fully Booked.
We're joined now by our editors with their top picks and books for the week. We have Young Readers editors Vicki Smith and Laura Simeon, nonfiction editor Eric Liebetrau, and fiction editor Lori Muchnick. Starting with Vicki, what's your choice for the week?
My choice for the week is Daniel Pinkwater's new book. It's called The Vampires of Blinch. That's B-L-I-N-S-H. And it's got illustrations by Aaron Rainier, who did a fabulous graphic novel a few years ago called The Unsinkable Walker Bean. And you know, this is a book that will seem, it's just sort of it, like you took, if you took Daniel Pinkwater and boiled him and then, you know, reboiled him, and it's like distilled Daniel Pinkwater. It doesn't really have a plot, but it introduces readers to the town of Blinch, which is in the state of Pennsylvania, in which 51% of the citizens are vampires. And it just sort of takes this very leisurely tour of town, talking about the various vampires and non-vampires and soon-to-be vampires that readers see. You learn about the properties of the Blinch vampires. They tend to float, and many of their non-vampire neighbors have learned how to float from watching them. But I will just read one page to give you an example of just sort of what I mean by a distillation of Daniel Pinkwater. The community room in City Hall on a typical evening. Parents are helping their children with homework. Some citizens are chatting. Others are eating donuts, discussing issues of the day, being bitten by vampires, or in the case of vampires, biting. It is a scene many readers will find familiar. So readers with a high tolerance for just plain weird are likely to love this. Readers who want something not weird should probably stay away. But it's been a while since Daniel Pinkwater's last book, and he's got a lot of fans out there, and I'm sure they'll be happy to see this. Yeah, I certainly was.
Yeah, thank you. I was going to mention that too. I'm a bit of a fan, and you know, this seems, my son actually loves weird and possibly plotless, so it seems like something good for him. But is it also like a good, he has this like mild interest in vampires, but he doesn't really totally understand them. Is this like a good entry point, or could you recommend something else?
Sorry. I have never been asked for an entry-level vampire book before in my life. And I can't think of one off the top of my head. You would have to do a little bit of, you know, of sort of connecting the dots for him. You know, sort of It's implied that when you're bitten by a vampire, you become vampirized. Mm-hmm. You have to lead into that. It doesn't get into how you slay vampires. And in fact, the vampires are not very scary. You wouldn't, you know, it's very unclear why you wouldn't want to become a vampire.
I see. Vampires, yeah, they seem very friendly.
Yeah. Well, or benign anyway, if not friendly.
Benign. Okay. Yeah.
They're just the vampires next door, man. So yeah. I will
Got
see
it.
If I can find an entry-level vampire book that is a little bit more classic feeling.
Yeah. All right. Thank you.
I'm like cracking up over here. Oh, that's really funny. Also, Daniel Pinkwater, Vicki, what a blast from the past. I knew somebody in college who really got me into Daniel Pinkwater really deeply for about like an intense 8 months. And I am so excited to see his name on our spreadsheet. And I'm so excited to hear you talk about this book. This is a delight.
In fact, it was a delight.
The title of the book is Vampires of Blinch by Daniel Pinkwater, with illustrations by Aaron Rainier. Thank you, Vicky, very much for that pick. Turning now to Laura's choice. Laura, what's your book of the week?
So my book this week is called Early Departures, and it's the second YA novel from Justin A. Reynolds. And last year he had Opposite of Always, which was also a great success, great hit. And this book, too, it's a realistic fiction story with a sort of science fiction-y element to it. And it follows these two boys who for years were best friends, Jamal and Quincy. Quincy goes by Q. And it's about their friendship falling apart and grief and love and second chances. So basically, Jamal's parents were killed tragically in this car accident that he blames Q for. And this leads to a rift in their friendship. Jamal's living with his older sister, and they're at a party at the lake. Quincy gets into trouble. He's drowning, and Jamal jumps in to try and save him. But unfortunately, Q dies. However, his grieving mother is offered this opportunity to take part in this experiment where he could be basically brought back to life for possibly up to 3 weeks or so. And this gives them all a chance for kind of closure, you know, of course, as soon as Q dies, Jamal has terrible regrets for not being more willing to speak honestly and try to resolve things. And there's also this echo in Jamal's relationship with his girlfriend, Autumn, where he's afraid to say, I love you, which becomes it becomes the final straw for her, because it's his fear holding him back after losing his parents, you know, after losing his best friend. He just has this terror that if he puts anything out there in the universe, he'll lose it. So it's about growth and personal relationships, and just a very thoughtful, introspective kind of story.
That sounds so good, Laura. It reminds me of Our Town by Thornton Wilder. You know, just the idea of bringing your kid or your best friend back for just a couple weeks. It's, you know, they would just be regular weeks, but it would be so unbearably poignant. How could you even live through it? It just sounds it's just like such a great setup for a book.
Yes. And that's actually one of the critical elements in the story is, do you tell the person or not? Because they just wake up and they restore them. They're sort of like rebooted to a certain point before before the death moment. So they don't necessarily know. But yeah, that's a great parallel.
Laura's pick is Early Departures by Justin A. Reynolds. Thank you, Laura, for that choice. Turning now to nonfiction, Eric, what have you got for us?
I'm going to go with sports today. I've been doing a lot of politics and heavy current affairs. Mm-hmm. So we'll get a little bit lighter, which of course is necessary. But yeah. The football season also just started. So there's a book called The Dynasty by Jeff Benedict. And it's about building of the New England Patriots over the past, 50 or 60 years. Basically went from, bottom dwellers to arguably the most well-run professional organization. And the cool thing about this, I mean, I'm a big football fan, so there's plenty of that stuff in here for fans of football. But the other cool thing is that it's very good about describing how a team runs, or how, the NFL is huge business. So you're talking about running a massive organization, and it does a great job of showing how, especially over the past 15 to 20 years, you had Tom Brady and Bill Belichick, who are kind of the duo, the coach and QB duo, who've really been the envy of the rest of the league, but also villains. So it's got this kind of really cool tension between, just the normal gridiron stuff and then a lot of really good personality stuff and business stuff even. So I would recommend it, and certainly great for Pats fans. So I know Vicky will be going out and getting it soon.
So Eric, I'm curious, because as a not very sporty person, would you say this is a book for diehard football fans, or is it the kind of human interest story that even if you don't know a lot about football, you could get a lot of enjoyment?
You You could get some. It's definitely, if you have no interest in football, you're not going to want to go through it because it's, you know, almost 500 pages. So I would say even if you have a little bit of interest, you may get something. Like I said, the kind of structural organizational elements are interesting for people who are into that. But I would say if you have no interest in football, then it's probably not. You should probably look elsewhere.
Good to know. Thanks. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I was looking elsewhere for the subtitle. There's no subtitle on this, Eric?
There's no subtitle because they're that pompous. You know, we're that good.
All right. The title, and just the title, no subtitle. The title is The Dynasty. It's by Jeff Benedict. Thank you, Eric, for that choice. Finally, we have Fiction with Lori. Lori, which book did you choose?
I would like to recommend the new mystery by Louise Penny, All the Devils Are Here. If you've been listening for a while, I definitely have recommended Louise Penny before. She's one of my favorite mystery writers, and I look forward to her books every year. You know, this year, I have been kind of wondering what it is that draws me to all of these mystery series about kind of really upright, always right, older male detectives, which seems a little questionable right now. But Armand Gamache, who's the head of the Sûreté du Québec in Canada, is a really great figure. And all around him is corruption and terrible things going on in the police department. So it's certainly not like Penny is idolizing or setting up the police or the government as any kind of unconflicted hero figures. But anyway, in this episode, Gamache goes to Paris. He, in the last few books in the series, he's been fighting all kinds of corruption, and he was the head of the police force for a while. Then he was demoted back to the head of homicide, and all kinds of things have been going on. And this book is kind of a very nice day trip for the reader, where we're going to leave this corruption investigation we've been going through, and we're going to go to Paris, where the Gamaches are visiting their children who both have moved over there. And, you know, of course he's there. He gets caught up in the middle of a murder investigation, which has to do with his godfather, and it's very close to their family, and his old friend who's the head of the Parisian police force. And I don't really need to tell you the details, but there's lots of local color and the Eiffel Tower and all kinds of things. And, you know, there's a lot of interpersonal family relationships in the Gamache family, you know, the children, you know, sibling rivalry, and, you know, who does their father love the most, all this kind of fun stuff. It's just delightful to read. So if you like mysteries at all, also the good thing about this book is that it's a good place to jump in. If you've never read Gamache before and you don't want to go all the way back to the beginning, you don't really need to know the whole backstory. So I would recommend it.
Yeah, count me as one of the people who's never read a single Louise Penny, which is sort of, it's a little heretical here in the state of Maine, because her books take place right over our border in a section of Quebec that is part of the what's called the Eastern Townships. And you know, I found myself really curious, knowing how popular she is here, and we love Louise Penny fairly consistently, but I was really curious to find out what the French Canadian press thought of her. And so I spent a little bit of time trying to, you know, devise, with the help of Laura's daughter, who is much more fluent in French than I am these days, devise Google search terms that would fetch me Canadian French language reviews. And they seem to like her well enough, but they don't seem to love her the same way that people here in the United States do. It was really interesting. A lot of the reviews were like, well, here's another one. She's got more coming. But, you know, nobody was, you know, seemed at all angry about the fact that this Anglophone Canadian who grew up in Ontario is adopting this French Canadian character and using him for her stories. But the level of enthusiasm just wasn't as high, which makes me wonder how much the French language, or, you know, sort of the Francophone Canadian culture details sort of heightens the enjoyment for U.S. readers who aren't familiar with that area. And it's just sort of more of the same for folks who are familiar with it. It was an interesting little dive.
That is really interesting. And that's an interesting theory. I feel like, you know, for so many people, reading a mystery series that's set in a different place becomes a lot about learning about that place. And if it's just a place that you already live, maybe it's kind of ho-hum. Also, I don't really know if in the French literary tradition, they have the same, I don't know much about mysteries in French and if they have the same, you know, taste. I know that, you know, when we get books from France, they're often quite different. Books that are popular or award-winning in France are actually often quite different than books that are award-winning or popular here. So that's an interesting question.
And when you add French Canada to that set of cultural layers, that makes it extra interesting to think about. I wish that I had more conclusive findings, though. I really wanted to find more than, yeah, there's another little mystery.
I know Donna Leon, who writes mystery set in Venice, and she's an American who lives in Venice. For all these years, she has not allowed her books to be translated into Italian. So, you know, I guess, I don't know if she fears that people are going to pick them apart or just, you know, she wants to be anonymous, I think, where she lives. But it's interesting. I wonder if the French Canadians are reading Louise Penny's books in English or if they're translated into French.
The reviews I saw were of translations. And one of the things I found very interesting is that they don't bother translating the town. It's Three Pines in the French editions as well as in the English editions.
Interesting. So the French editions kind of making the whole thing seem a little Englishy.
Maybe. Subtly.
It's kind of shady. Yeah.
I didn't glean that from the reviews, but it's possible it's there.
Oh, Shady Pines. The title of Lori's pick this week is All the Devils Are Here. It is by the one, the only, Louise Penny. Thank you, Lori, for that choice. Well, that does it for another episode of Fully Booked. We made it through a smoke-filled episode of Fully Booked. Whew, wiping my brow. Thank you for joining us this week. Please join us again next week when my guest will be Francina Simone. She is the author of Smash It, a stellar YA novel, according to our reviewer who gave it a star. Really fun book. Can't wait to talk with her about that then. It's also Banned Books Week, so we will be talking with our editors. A little departure from the usual recommendations. We'll be talking about the significance of Banned Books Week and some banned books news. So you won't want to miss it. But until then, you know what to do. Turn this thing off and go read a book.
Thanks for listening to Fully Booked by Kirkus Reviews. Check out new episodes every Tuesday at podcastone.com, on the Podcast One app, or you can subscribe on iTunes.